Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Cindy said that my bouncer was out there guarding people and all. I thought, well, maybe he's the cherubim. Did he have the flaming sword guarding the garden? But he has to go. He's counting ballots. Uh-huh. And so he'll be back after he gets the ballots counted, which of course we definitely won't, because we're all worried about how the outcome's going to be, right? Thank you. Well, it's good to see you again today. I'll ask again, any new people for the first time in here today? Good. Well, good. Two of you. Okay, I always like to start with a little review of what we did last week, and that kind of gets people back on board. One piece of housekeeping first. I did start that. Thank you. I have somebody to remind me to start that. The sheet for next week that you usually get, Tim said, and I remind you, the printer's stuck, it wouldn't work, so you have to go to the website this week, or the newsletter, it'll be in the newsletter, and you can click on the appropriate link and print that off for yourself for next week. So, last week we began looking at culture misdirected. We're in Act 2 of the great drama of the Bible, Rebellion in the Kingdom. The fall of Adam and Eve is kind of the first scene. The second scene is culture misdirected, and we began looking at the story of Cain and Abel. Well, we started out talking about how we see in Adam and Eve the creation, and then humanity involves a vocation, being called to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth, to be in relationship, and there's permission. You can eat anything in the garden. Provision, I like to say too, permission and provision. There's also prohibition. You can't eat of this tree. There's boundaries in any healthy relationship, in any healthy life. There's provision, permission, and there's also prohibition, boundaries, and call to be in relationship. So we see that in Adam and Eve, and we see that carried throughout the story. And then we looked at Cain and Abel and how the corruption, the distortion of God's good creation, of this plan of God, the shalom of creation, that is corrupted, it's distorted, and ramped up now with Adam, with Cain and Abel, as we have sibling rivalry, we have jealousy, envy, murder, the first violence, murder in the Bible, and so really the disobedience to God, the lack of trust in God is ramped up in this violation of human relationship. But at the end of the story, we saw how with Cain being sentenced to be a wanderer in the earth, goes out and instead of wandering decides to build a city. And so we have the beginning of culture. And we see a city developed, and then in the genealogy following Cain, we have various people named, and it names their trades. There's a poet, there's a musician, there's a bronze and iron worker, there's agriculturalist. So again, the beginnings of culture as humanity expands, and civilization develops, culture develops. And yet we see then, as we move to the story of Noah, how culture itself, which is a good thing, part of the creativity God calls us to, we're co-creators, we're partners in creation with God, that's part of our vocation, and yet that gets distorted, gets corrupted in culture. And at the beginning of the story of Noah, and you heard this morning in the sermon, it was our memory verse to today. The Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. I mean, how can you underline something anymore? Every inclination, only evil continually. So culture, humanity that's now developed civilization, that culture has now become distorted, corrupted, depraved, we might say. And so God decides to make a clean start, to wipe the slate clean. We talked about how the flood story is really two different stories from the different literary traditions. For those who weren't here, the southern writer, the Yahwist, and the priestly writer, there's two different stories, and we teased out some of those differences, like in the numbers of the length of time of the flood and all. So there's two stories that are very expertly woven together. Really, the editor, the one who wove all these stories together, employs his own creativity. It's kind of wonderful the way the story's developed. So these stories of the flood drawing on other ancient flood stories and other religions at the time, pulling some of those elements into the story. And we talked, as we've talked in the past, these are mythic stories, meaning that all the facts may not necessarily be scientifically and factually true or provable, but there's a deep truth. There's a profound truth about humanity and about God and about the story of humanity and our relationship with each other and with God. Profound truth in these great mythic stories. And so with the flood, the wiping of the slate clean, we return to chaos, back to the beginning of creation. The Hebrew word was tohu vabohu, we learned. Formless and normless. Waters came from below, the fountains of the deep. Waters came from above, through the windows of heaven. Everything is thrown into total chaos. So you have this huge flood covering everything, just like the chaos, the tohu vabohu at the beginning of creation when God began to bring order. And so God is going to do a new creation, just to kind of start all over again. And we went through some of the stages of the flood last week, and then when we stopped, because our time ran out, and I have those wonderful jokes. You remember those jokes I ended with? The ark has just landed on the top of Mount Ararat. And the first thing God says is, go out and be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Vocation. Same vocation as in Genesis to Adam and Eve. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Same vocation. The vocation is renewed. And so we have a new start. We're going to pick up there today. And I still have my sore throat. So Cindy assures me that it'll only take 3 or 4 weeks before I get over this, because she's been struggling with it too. So please bear with me. I did bring my own coffee. I learned to bring my own coffee. Because the cherubim with the flaming sword won't let me get coffee here before class.
Now, I did ask the pastor in question today why we were being punished for coming to Sunday school. I didn't get a good answer.
It's not punishment. It's efficiency. It's an attempt to bring order and harmony to the class process. Because sometimes just introducing coffee brings chaos, right? Also brings fellowship. Well, we can go down that path for a while, can't we? So the ark has landed, and Tim told us, had a great sermon today on some of the aspects of grief and grace in the flood story, the story of Noah. And, you know, the picture of God is in some ways a very human picture of God. It's God who has emotions, God who changes. Lois Hostetler afterwards says, does God change? I said, well, maybe that's what the sermon was about, huh? But in some respects, God changes. Well, that's one of the issues in the story. God was grieved. God first decided to wipe out everybody, but then said, no, there's this famine. We're going to start over. So you've got grief and grace, and you've got a God who has emotions, a God who responds to humanity. What's relationship all about if it's not about interaction and response to one another? You know, if God's up there, the theological term is ase, totally the unmoved mover, you know, in a fortress, distant, totally transcendent. Tim's sermon from a few weeks ago, transcendent and immanent. If God is totally transcendent, is God really in relationship with us? If God doesn't respond to us as we respond to God, relationship involves responding to one another in love and interaction. So we see that in the Noah story. It's a very, it's just a great story, but it's also a great glimpse into God. The verse that says God remembered Noah, in the Hebrew, the term really is more accurately translated, God paid attention, or God was attentive to Noah. So it's not like God forgot Noah, it's like God was attentive to the fact that Noah was responsive and obedient and faithful. Noah walked with God, and so Noah becomes the basis for the remnant, the basis for the recreation of humanity as the slate is wiped clean. So we pick up the story, and the ark has landed, and what's the first thing that Noah did? You know the story? I need to make out a test. I mean, just tell this right.
Shoveled it out.
Shoveled it out. Yeah, well, after shoveling. Would you like to teach? Well, they're leaving the ark so they don't have to shovel the ark out. So what was the first thing Noah did? Built an altar, remember?
Yeah.
Built an altar. The reason that one of the versions of the story has seven of the animals instead of two each is so they'll have extra animals to make a sacrifice on the altar. So an act of worship, which was important. This is all written down at the time of the exile, you know, after they've had worship established. So retelling this or telling the story now, the importance of worship is woven into the story. And so Noah builds an altar, and it says the odor of the burnt sacrifice was pleasing to God. It's an interesting, I can't cite the Hebrew words, but in Hebrew it's a word play which might be translated, God smelled the soothing savor. So it's kind of like an alliteration or kind of a word play as part of this beautiful story, which is pleasing to hear and reflects the pleasingness of the sacrifice to God. And then God makes a promise. Promises not to curse the ground. Remember the curse of the ground with Adam as part of the sentence for Adam's disobedience. And the curse of the ground again with Cain, so that it would be even harder to till the soil. That's part of the consequences of disobedience. God says, never again am I going to curse the ground. And never again am I going to destroy every living creature. In the end of the story of Noah, the phrase never again occurs six times. That's really emphasizes that. Never again. See, God's changing. Never again. And we hear that today in reference to the Holocaust, right? Never again. We need to retell the story of the Holocaust so that it will never again happen. Those important words, and that's a good sermon title. Never again. You can ring the changes on that. So, never again, this kind of destruction. And it's interesting, permission and prohibition, God's kind of putting a prohibition on God's own self. God says, well, maybe I have some boundaries too. That's kind of an interesting, a teasing thought, that God is placing boundaries on God's own self. Never again am I going to reap this kind of destruction, no matter how sinful. It says, no matter how inclined toward evil the human heart is, it's like God knows that humans are going to fall again, but never again. Alfred?
So, what do you do with the time clock is 3 minutes to 12? So, we've got...
I sort of say, what? It's only 3 minutes. You're speaking metaphorically. These stories are all metaphorical, Chris, so thank you.
I mean, does that mean people should have hope that God will allow the destruction of humanity? Or are these two?
Well, I don't know that
really
God says He won't allow it. God says, never again will I destroy out of anger. But we can still, as Tim said in the sermon this morning, there's still justice, there's still consequences. We live with the consequences of our own actions. That doesn't mean God, in anger, decides to wipe us out again. And it's interesting that in the two stories woven together, in this part of the story, He says, never again will I destroy the earth because of human sinfulness. Later He says, in the other version, of the other part of the other tradition that's woven in, He says, never again will I destroy it by water. And then the conjectures, well, but by fire, maybe later. We heard that little song. It's like He said, when destruction comes by fire, the boat will still float. That's a great song. I love that song. I actually remembered part of it. So it's interesting. You can kind of see evidence of the two stories woven together. And one of them is never again in any way will I destroy. The second one says never again by water. So anyway, he makes the promise, and then God blesses Noah and his family and the animals. Remember the theme of blessing back in creation? God blessed four times. Blessed the birds and the fish, and then He blessed the land animals, the domestic animals and the wild animals, and then He blessed humans, and then the fourth blessing was what? You remember? It's my test. The Sabbath. blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So the theme of blessing, again, this new creation story, again, God sends out with vocation, never again am I going to destroy, and God blesses Noah and Noah's family and the animals to be fruitful and multiply. And that theme of blessing we're going to see carrying on. The next part of the story we come to next week, Abraham and Sarah and their family are blessed to be a blessing to the other nations and people. So getting ahead in the story a little bit, Tim gave us permission to do that. Blessing is an important theme that comes up over and over. And so you see that here in the Noah story too. And again, the vocation. As they go out, God says, Yahweh says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Only this time, it's like God has realized that humanity is going to fall again. That disobedience is going to re-enter the picture. And so there are some concessions to the weakness of humanity. For one thing, it says in the story that as they go out that the animals will fear humans. So you've got fear, another theme that's kind of come up before. But it's like, I know humanity's going to have problems really living out this vocation I've given them in a positive and peaceful way. So the animals are going to fear. And now you can eat meat. Remember originally, the plants were given to the animals and humans to eat. It was a vegetarian world in the garden. Now, as a concession to human frailty, you can eat meat, but there's a boundary. You can't eat meat with this blood in it. Blood is a very powerful symbol, the symbol of life. Blood was believed, thought to contain life, so you can't eat fresh meat that's got blood still in it. And that's behind the kosher laws of today. If you've ever kosher, you salt the meat so that it draws all the blood out of it. If you're an observant Jew at Passover, for instance, You salt your meat and get all the blood out of it. That's part of it relates to this prohibition. You can't eat meat with the blood in it. And so you still have permission and prohibition, and you have this sort of concession to the fact that humanity's changed now. Humanity is sinful. I'm going to say a red flag word, original sin. Everybody screw up your face. Original sin. So, for me, my way of understanding original sin is that it's talking about the origin of sin. It's not something that you inherit through your genetically or whatever, but it's the origin of sin. And the story of the fall and Cain and Abel and the corruption of civilization is about the origin of sin, the introduction of disobedience and sinfulness into the world, and how that affects all of us. It's not something we inherit, but it's something that from the moment we're born, we begin to be affected by it. I was trying to think of an example. Think of a couple who gets married and they're living happily ever after and they have a child and things are going great, and then for some reason the parents get into doing drugs and then manufacturing drugs and selling them, and they get arrested in jail, and then they get out of jail and then they have another child. The second child is innocent but will never not be affected by the fact that this family is now affected by having fallen into drug dealing. You could take any other sin, adultery or corruption, financial corruption. The family is influenced and affected by that sin, and so the child, the new child born, and the other child, the whole family, there's no way they cannot be affected by that, even though they themselves are innocent to begin with. So, to me, that's kind of what original sin is. Sin came into the world, and so humanity has been infected by this sin. And anybody that's born into the world, born innocent, born a good creation of God, and yet the influence of sin is there, and there's no way you can escape it. You remember in the Cain and Abel story, when you do good, you will be accepted, but sin is crouching at the door. If you do ill. Sin's just waiting to grab you in its clutches, it said in the Cain and Abel story. That's kind of sin now kind of has a reality of its own. And so for me, that's kind of what original sin means. I had a question passed to me in a note from Cindy after the sermon. if recreating the world, why does original sin continue and maintain? So that kind of addresses that question. To me, it's not that original sin is something that we're born sinners. I don't think we're born sinners. We're born imago Dei, image of God, good. But original sin is we're born into a sinful world and that's going to affect us. And ultimately, just by human nature, we're going to fall into sin of our own to one degree or another. How significant or immense the original sin that it culminated in desolation and the horrors of the world today have not risen to that level. I would just say, well, have they or have they not? You know, they haven't risen to the level that, because God said never again, that God destroyed the earth, but some would, you know, I would say that in the Holocaust, for instance, that the horrors of Noah's time before the flood have been met, and maybe in other ways in the world. So the presence of sins around us. The ultimate cost of the fall is that we will live with the unraveling that comes from brokenness, sin, and separation. It's true. We've distorted creation. And so here in the story, when God restates the vocation, but then it's like God realizes humanity has now entered a state of fallenness, and I'm going to have to keep coming back and forgiving and having new starts. And that's what the whole story is about. Over and over again, God working to renew and recreate, humans falling, God coming back, again, recreating, forgiving, starting over, humanity falling. That's the whole trajectory of the salvation history, is God's project of continually working to save us, to restore that goodness in us, even though we continually rebel against that. So then it says God makes a covenant. This is the other strand of the story. God said never again. And now God makes a covenant. So makes it official, a covenant. And says never by flood. And this is the first of, who can tell me how many covenants there are in the Bible? Five. The first is the Noachic covenant. That's a mouthful for you. Everybody say that. Noachic. Noachic. Okay. Noachic covenant with Noah, and it's a covenant with all creation, with Noah and his family and all creation. Second is the Abraham covenant, the Abrahamic covenant with Abraham and Sarah and their family, and it's a special covenant to select the Jewish people, the Israelites, to be the carrier of God's blessing. Third is the Mosaic, Moses covenant, the Ten Commandments. We think of that as the covenant, and that's the third covenant, actually. Again, there's been chaos and slavery, and another creation as they're delivered out through the wilderness, tohu va-bohu, the wilderness, to a new start in the Promised Land, and another covenant with the Ten Commandments and 613 other laws. And then the Davidic covenant, as they enter a time of the monarchy, of the kingship, and so God makes a covenant with David to continue to lead Israel through a kingship. And then the fifth one is the new covenant in my blood, which is Jesus. Jeremiah talks about it. There will be a new covenant written on the heart, not on tables of stone, remember? A prophecy. And then Jesus says, this cup is a new covenant in my blood. So for us Christians, that's the fifth covenant. So five covenants. All of those are, you know, crisis, fall again, covenant and renewal and recreation. Crisis, covenant and renewal and recreation. Crisis, covenant and renewal and recreation. So covenant's a very important theme, concept, or reality. Part of God's continue, keeps coming back with the promise and the saving action to bring us back to the goodness God wants. And so there's going to be a sign. Now I can take my coat off because I brought my visual aid. Meredith said we ought to video these instead of just audio. Well, this is why, because people would like to see my rainbow suspenders. So there's a sign, which is the rainbow in the sky. So it's kind of like a sacrament. You know, the little thumbnail definition of a sacrament. A sacrament is an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace. And so the rainbow is the sign or the seal on the covenant that God's made, never again to destroy the earth. I like that. A sign of forgiveness, a sign of recreation, a sign of mercy and hope. I mean, you know, the rainbow is a wonderful sign. It's no wonder it's been adopted by various kinds of human rights movements, gay rights, environmental rights. It's all part of the environment. So just a wonderful sign, the rainbow. And like any sacrament, there's a physical thing that's a reminder. And the interesting thing is, in the story it says, I'm going to place this rainbow in the sky as a sign to remind me. The rainbow's not there to remind us. Not the way the story's written. The rainbow's there to remind God. So here's that thing about God grieving over the desolation and the corruption of the goodness God created. God grieves that. God forgives, starts again. And God's going to say, unless I get tempted to be angry and wipe everybody out again, I'm going to remind myself of this rainbow. And when it starts to rain and a flood's imminent, whoops, there's the rainbow. Oh, no, I can't do that again. So, you know, it's interesting. I've always tended to think of the rainbow as a reminder to us, and it is. You know, we see it, wow, I remember that story, and that's a great love and promise of God. But God says the rainbow is to remind God's own self about recreation and mercy and a new start. So, interesting. One other interesting thing about the rainbow, the bow is a weapon. And when people decided not to have a war, they would hang the bow up as a symbol that they were going to be pursuing peace instead of war. So there's kind of another part of the symbolism is the rainbow is a symbol of peace rather than destruction. So it's a very, very rich symbol.
Joel, could we say that the rainbow is to remind God of who God is?
Sure.
Like various people in the Old Testament, they take it upon themselves to remind God of who he is. Like Abraham, yeah. Far be it from you to do this.
When you say remind God of who God is, I was thinking about the question of God to Adam in the garden, you know, where are you, which is kind of an identity question, you know. Who are you? What did I create you to be? Where are you? And the rainbow then is like, okay, oh, who am I as God? Oh, yeah, I said I would never again do this. So, yeah, that's a good insight. Yeah, and you see people being bold enough to ask God and to remind God throughout Scripture. So the story sort of comes to a wonderful end at that point, except then, as Tim pointed out, we have this little postscript, which says, original sin. It says, sin is all around, and here even Noah, with a second chance, a new start, goes out from the ark, begins to develop culture again, he plants a vineyard, and makes grapes, and then he figures out how he can make wine. Well, that's a blessing. Then he abuses the wine. He distorts the goodness of culture, the goodness of creation, the goodness of this plant, that God, the fruitfulness symbolized by the grapes. He distorts that and gets drunk. And then his son Ham walks in and sees him lying naked. He gets drunk, falls out naked. Yeah, boy, that brings back some memories of college days. I won't go there. I'll tell you that story later. But he falls out naked. And so Ham walks in and sees his dad's nakedness, and of course he's embarrassed. He runs out. He doesn't do anything. He runs out and gets his other brothers. The other brothers come in and they take the cloak and they back in so they won't look on their dad's nakedness and lay the cloak over their dad. So Noah comes to, and he's furious that furious that his son Ham has seen him, and he's ashamed. Adam and Eve disobey. All of a sudden they saw their nakedness. Their eyes were open, thinking this was good, but they all of a sudden they're ashamed and guilty. Noah, this is kind of totally redoing the story, you see. Noah is ashamed, and then he lashes out in anger at Ham and curses Ham and Ham's son Canaan and all his generation. So, after that. So, again, culture misdirected, culture distorted, and we have a return to kind of chaos in relationships. That story, the curse of Ham, was used to justify slavery because the story says Ham and his descendants are going to be slaves to Shem and Japheth, the other two sons, and their children. So Ham's sons are going to be slaves to the other two, and so that was used to justify slavery. Oh, it's right here in the Bible. It says they're supposed to be slaves. Well, that's a chaotic result of broken relationship. That's not God's will. That's not God's intent. But it was used to justify slavery. So again, you see how the goodness of a new creation is totally distorted and corrupted again. And it results in alienation within their own family, alienation from God, alienation with creation and turning the blessed gift of wine into drunkenness, alienation between races down through the centuries. And we still reap the results of that today. You know, racism is alive and well, unfortunately. So culture misdirected, part of the results of not trusting God's way and distorting the goodness for our own selfish ends, putting ourselves in the place of God. And so we have this, you think, couldn't they have left that story out? But it's the nature of reality. And it sets the stage for the next work of God to bring covenant and try a different way of bringing new creation and hope and forgiveness to humanity. So let's take a pause here. We're doing well on time. And think about the stories that we've heard in these first three classes. Adam and Eve, the creation, and then the fall, Adam and Eve's disobedience, the entrance of sin into the world, Cain and Abel, and the ramping up of the disobedience into violence and murder, sibling rivalry, and civilization becoming so corrupt that God wipes the slate clean and has a new start through Noah, and now Noah falls again. So think about these stories, and I'd like you to respond. Which of these stories do you feel like has the most relevance to us today? I was going to say, which is your favorite and most interesting story? And I was talking to Ellen this morning, and she was asking me, which one of those stories do you think has the most relevance? I thought, this is a better question. So which of those, these powerful, true stories, differences in the facts, contradictions factually. Genesis is not a science book. It's not a book about facts. It's a theology book. It's a book about who we are as humans, who God is as God, and what's our relationship. And so the truth, the great truth, the deeper truth, you know, facts and science tell you a truth about things on the surface level. But this is a deeper truth about human nature and God's nature and our relationship and our calling and what we do. So of these stories, which one do you think has the most relevance for today and why? What's your name?
Amy.
Amy, thank you, Amy.
This is my first time in this class, so maybe I shouldn't talk, but
go ahead.
I think, I mean, all of these stories have certain value, but I've been, just from Tim's sermon and from your discussion today, going over and over in my mind about the significance of this flood story, and that God setting boundaries on himself and on the punishment he would impose opens us up to a more relational existence with God. It opens us up to more opportunities to demonstrate mercy on our part, to demonstrate growth on our part, and that he's sharing some of the responsibility in that by setting those boundaries on himself.
Okay.
So that's the relevance, I guess, I'm seeing.
Which it kind of reflects for you that real interactive relationship between God and us, and we have responsibility. God has responsibility in that, and we have responsibility in that. That's good.
I think in Judaism, isn't it true that sometimes people sort of argue with God? I mean, that's the same sort of thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That there's a back and forth.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Who was it that was saying that, you see that the questions that you Meredith coming up where people ask God about, you know, remember who you are, God. You know, in the Psalms, we think of the Psalms as being praise Psalms, but there's, I forget the number, but it's like 2/3 of the Psalms are laments. They're not praises. And a lament is a way of saying, you know, how long, O Lord? You know, it's a way of kind of challenging God and interacting with God. You know, in Job it says, curse God and die. Well, sometimes we need to, why are you doing this, God? My God, why have you forsaken me? You know, Jesus did that. So that interaction, that relational relationship with God, that God, you know, God's got big enough shoulders to take it. So, yeah, that's a good point. Meredith?
Well, I'm very interested in your idea about what original sin is. I've always thought that Adam and Eve, even though they had everything that you could possibly want in the garden, they still wanted their own way rather than God's way. And it seems to me that that is the story which has so much relevance for us today.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the United States, look how blessed we are. I mean, you could say, as many people have said, was any country ever so blessed? And yet, look at how we've chosen to use that. I mean, we are we are just militarized to the hilt. And look how we treat our own people. You know, I mean, Flint, Michigan, Ferguson,
you know. Yeah. Jane Addams, who is one of the founders of the social work movement, the Whole House in Chicago, she has a quotation I've used before. The essence of immorality is to make an exception of yourself. So that's what Adam and Eve, the essence of immorality is to make an exception of myself. So Adam and Eve, you can't eat anything except this one tree. Maybe that doesn't apply to me. it's about self-centered. It's about putting ourselves in the place of God. God has given us the permission and the provision and all these wonderful things in our country and in the world. And God has said to live healthily. There are certain boundaries, and if you cross those boundaries, you're going to die. It's going to bring something. It's going to bring death. It's going to bring, if not a physical death, a spiritual death, a moral death to you if you cross certain boundaries. You certainly know that in marriage. You know that in your relationship in families. If you don't have healthy boundaries, you bring a death into your family. And so I was going somewhere with that. when we make an exception of ourselves, we're saying, oh, but those boundaries don't apply to me. And then, so then we've crossed the boundaries, the prohibition, and we've distorted, corrupted the goodness of creation. It includes healthy boundaries that God has given us. The Ten Commandments are about boundaries. The laws are about boundaries. And sometimes, you know, some boundaries can be overstated or, you know, they need to be tweaked. But still, the importance of boundaries for a good, healthy life that God wants for us. But when we make an exception of self, that's the essence of sin or immorality, according to Jane Addams. Otherwise, these stories are relevant. What's relevant? What do you see about them?
I think it's more the overview, too, of how many times, as I relate to those who struggle and make mistakes over and over again, how many times do I allow those in my life to start over anew? Mm. Do I give forgiveness Not that there's not consequences, but what, how, you know, maybe I'm putting myself as this on God, but, you know, but how many chances do you, you know, our humanness would be, did you only give people a finite chance?
I liked what Tim said this morning when he talked about, you know, the two poles of justice and mercy, or judgment and love, and there are people who are all on the judgment side, you know, who, you know, they misbehave, they've got to reap the consequences, we've got to give them the consequences, usually, you know, put themselves in that position, you know, and that's, it forgets about mercy. But then the other side can go to the wrong extreme too. It's all permission, it's all with no boundaries,
right.
And, you know, it's all enabling, and it's too easily forgiving. So I'll, you know, Pam's prayer request made me think in our family, we have a son who's made some bad choices and had a lot of struggle in his life, continues to have. And so he lives in Kansas, and he's deaf. He and his former wife are both deaf and have four beautiful grandkids for us. But, you know, he's always struggled financially. He keeps making bad decisions. He, you know, he calls up and says, "Dad, I don't have the money to pay the rent this month, and, you know, can you help me out?" And so now, judgment and mercy, justice, consequences are important. You learn by experiencing the consequences versus he's going to be put out on the street. You know, last winter he lived in his car. He didn't tell us till afterwards, but in the bitter cold of January and February, he was in his car for a couple of months. So that's a struggle that I have. How do I love and forgive and give a second chance, you know? But boundaries are important. How do I, in the love and the forgiveness and the second chance, how do I maintain healthy boundaries in my relationship with my son? You know, if I'm just always bailing him out, you know, is that the best thing to do? You know, so that's something that's a process, and I pray, as Pam said this morning, pray for God's guidance, because I don't know what the right, you know, and it comes up again, you know, he'll get past this crisis, and then a few months later, here comes another crisis, so I've got to wrestle with it all over again, so.
I agree, it's more of a theme, and I think I keep coming back to your theme on number one there, the vocation, permission, provision, and you don't talk about it in those nice concrete boxes you've got drawn up there, because it's, like you said, it's like that.
Mm-hmm.
I keep coming back to the relationship part. And I come across as very stern and judging, and it goes way back. It may also come from the fact of my family, my extended family. Very few have not been addicted. Mm-hmm. And I limit myself to going to that environment. Had my youngest cousin, 28, overdosed, killed himself. I don't know if he purposely killed himself, but the overdose killed him. He finally is not daunted by all the demons that have plagued him and other family members. And I keep thinking about the relationship and how I have done something different. It's not an easy answer, but I keep coming back to that, and it's not blocked. His judgment's not blocked, his love is not blocked, his, you know, the boundary.
Yeah.
And did I make the right choice or not? I don't know. And that's, you know, like you said, you know, with your son, it's that, but it's having that conversation, both with myself, with God, with others.
And there remains, you know, again, Tim referred to it at the close of his sermon, there remains a mystery and a puzzling aspects and a complexity to it. So, you know, when you put it in these nice clean blocks, you know, it helps you understand it, but there's still, you know, it's a process, and there's still a lot of complexity to it. And you come in, that's why the story keeps cycling, is because we continue to fall back in. And so what in our relationship, you know, covenant's about relationship. God makes a covenant, that's a relationship word, a promise, a mutuality in covenant. The rainbow reminds us, and it reminds God, there's a mutuality and stuff, but then how do you live that out? It can get kind of messy and complicated, and the answer is not always obvious. Yeah.
And how do I protect my daughters from that? And, you know, so it's all wrapped up.
Okay. So that sounds like our time. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, our time's about up. One quick reference to the other story we never got to, and that's the Tower of Babel, or Babel, and that again is how civilization then now rebuilds, and then culture gets misdirected, and the gift of human ingenuity and creativity, technology, making bricks, building a tower, that's technology. One of my questions if we had time was, how is the gift of technology today distorted and misused to put ourselves on the throne and to bring death and destruction? I mean, it's not that technology is bad. It's not that making bricks and building a tower or using your smartphone is bad. But how is that misdirected? And so the Tower of Babel is, again, is moving this even another step to culture getting corrupted and distorted. And language, the whole question of language is involved in there. There are one language, and so then the languages are divided and they're dispersed out into the different nations. There's consequences. So it's another great story. And it's about, again, how the gifts and the goodness that God has given us are misused. And so now God's going to come back with a new approach to start the creation process, the hope process, the love process, again. And somebody told me a joke last week. I'll close with a joke again. Who was it that told me? How long did Cain hate his brother? As long as he was able. Who told me that joke?
That is really bad. Huh?
Oh, okay, he's not here today. Okay, so, well, thank you very much. So next week we turn to Abraham and Sarah and the call of a special people to bring blessing.